Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. And we are going to have a really interesting first hour and second hour today. We're going to be concentrating on a colorblind society and how it's playing out in the Democratic race for the presidency. As you well know by now, it's been all over the news. Geraldine Ferraro, the vice presidential nominee in 1984, told a California newspaper, and evidently has said this on radio programs and in speeches as well, if Obama was a white man, he would not be in this position. If he was a woman of any race, he would not be in this position. He happens to be very lucky to be who he is, and the country is caught up in the concept. The Obama campaign called a midday conference yesterday in which Obama's chief strategist, David Axelrod, said all this is part of an insidious pattern that needs to be addressed, suggesting that Clinton is trying to send a signal to her supporters that anything goes. As you know, Geraldine Ferraro resigned from her position as somebody who's helping raising money for the Clinton campaign. Obama had an interesting response to this. When asked about her remarks, he said that being an African-American man named Barack Obama was not the quickest path to becoming U.S. president. Anybody who knows the history of this country, he said, I think, would not take too seriously the notion that this has been a huge advantage, but I don't think it's disadvantaged either. And then yesterday, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton apologized. She spoke before a group of 200 black community newspapers across the country. The biggest apology in response to a question about comments by her husband after the South Carolina primary. Bill Clinton said Jesse Jackson also won South Carolina when he ran for president in 84 and 88. She said, I want to put that in context. You know, I am sorry if anyone was offended. It was certainly not meant in any way to be offensive. So let's talk about race again and about how far we are from being a truly colorblind society and whether or not this issue of race is deliberately being placed in the presidential discussion by the Clinton campaign and how we all feel about it. We have two wonderful guests with us the first hour of the program, and I'm sure we'll have a ton of phone calls on this issue as well. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, if that's easier, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We have two guests with us, Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, who has joined us before, Associate Professor of Politics and African-American Studies at Princeton University. Professor Harris-Lacewell, thanks so much again for being with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
And Professor Walter Farrell, who used to be in Milwaukee. I miss him. He hasn't been here for a few years, but it seems like he was here yesterday. He's now Professor of Management and Community Practice at the School of Social Work and also Associate Director of the Urban Investment Strategies Center at the Business School at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Long time no talk to you. It's nice to speak with you again, Professor Farrell.
Good to chat with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you both here. Let's start with Geraldine Ferraro's comments yesterday, which have been pretty roundly criticized and pretty seriously criticized by some commentators on television. How did both of you take those comments? I don't know what the heck she was saying. What was she talking about?
Well, my take on them is that they're part of a deliberate pattern, and I didn't come to this conclusion lightly, by the Clintons to inject race into the campaign. And I've said elsewhere that I think the Clintons as a team, and I voted for Bill Clinton twice in the 1990s, willing to do anything to win. And I think their overall strategy is to place Barack Obama in a black box that diminish and marginalize him as a black candidate. So even if he wins the nomination, he will be so damaged that he will lose to John McCain. And then in 2012, Hillary can come back and say, I told you so. You should have selected me. And now I'm going to run unencumbered by Barack Obama. That's one prong of the strategy. The second prong is to use the same strategy to diminish him in such a way that she will be able to garner the delegates at the convention to put her over the top. And then she will toss out the olive branch to Barack Obama and saying, let's let bygones be bygones. Hmm. I want you on my ticket as my VP, because she and Bill Clinton know that if she wins the nomination at this point, it'll be so polarized that African-American voters will stay home.
Mm-hmm.
And they will need that turnout in key states to win. So they're perfectly comfortable to have him on the vice have him on the ticket as vice president, because of the fact that they were able to marginalize Al Gore like that for a year. So they have experience in marginalizing vice presidents. But, and I said earlier, and I don't want to take up too much time, that when you start in January with a pattern, and that's why I did not come to this lightly, Bill Clinton and the Fairytale comment, and then later the Jesse Jackson comparison in South Carolina.
Right.
Then she sent Charlie Shaheen out before the New Hampshire primary and essentially questioned whether or not Barack was a drug dealer. Then they, and this has been a diverse coalition, because they sent Charlie Rangel out to call Obama stupid after he said her comments about Dr. King and President Johnson were ill-advised. And that's a stereotype directed to black, toward black males and females. Then he sent Andrew Young came out and said that Clinton was every bit as black as Obama. Then Bob Johnson reinforcing the drug dealer situation. Then Senator, former Senator Bob Kerry highlighting Obama's Muslim middle name and his mother, his grandmother's Muslim religion.
Mm-hmm.
Then the distribution of the picture of Obama in Muslim garb and Hillary's categorical refusal to say that Obama is a Christian.
Right, that was amazing. As far as I know.
As far as I know.
Yeah.
And then Bill Clinton in Mississippi said, well, Obama, you know, that would be an unstoppable ticket. Obama would carry the urban areas, i.e. the minorities. And then Geraldine Ferraro coming after that and say, well, hell, he wouldn't be this far if he wasn't black. And then Clinton's own campaign never directly apologizing for Ferraro's remark until she got before the Black Journal. And then she used the words reject and denounce, which he had refused to use 2 days earlier. And they let this stay in the ether for 15 days. So this is part of a political pattern. And if I'm looking at this clearly from a political angle, I would say, hey, it's the thing to do. Negative campaigning has been shown to work for both Democrats and Republicans in this country.
Yeah. And Professor Harris-Lacewell, I loved Obama's comment here, because this is what makes Ferraro's comments so, as he says, ridiculous. Being an African-American man named Barack Obama is not the quickest path to becoming U.S. president. That's true, isn't it?
Well, certainly, that's true, but I think it goes beyond that. I mean, I love the analysis that I just heard from the professor. Certainly, you know, this is a clear and cogent way of thinking about how the Clinton campaign has behaved around race. But I think that if we allow it to sit just with the Clinton campaign, and to imagine that as good as they are, and Lord knows they are, that they're not so sort of puppet masters who are controlling their surrogates any more than the Barack Obama campaign or puppet masters controlling their surrogates. I actually think that it goes deeper to a set of expectations and beliefs that we have as Americans broadly, and that as distressing and disturbing as this is, it also gives us an opportunity to have a conversation about our misunderstandings about race. So let's take this, right, in a kind of spirit of Obama moment. And instead of just having a fight about the Clintons and how sort of bad and misguided they are, let's instead say, okay, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Why is it that it would be a useful and productive strategy to mock someone as Muslim? What does that say about who we are as a country?
Mm-hmm.
Why would it be a productive and useful strategy to make this kind of inference that affirmative action pushes forward unqualified black people, you know, at all levels, including the U.S. presidency, right? I'm very keen on asking, why would anyone in the country, including Geraldine Ferraro, imagine that being born a black man named anything is a sort of good lottery ticket pick? Like, since when does being born a black man lead to anything other than, right, the likelihood of living in a poor neighborhood, the likelihood of dying young, the likelihood of being incarcerated, the likelihood of developing diabetes and prostate cancer. I mean, we could just sort of go down a whole list of things that being born African-American in this country means. And what it doesn't mean is that you have a much better shot at being president.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Professor Farrell, that the Clintons were absolutely shocked that they lost the black vote? He'd been called the first black president. They had prided themselves with reaching out to, you know, black churches and talking as though they understood the problems of African-Americans, and that it's just come at them, and they thought they were going to have this thing locked up, and now they have a sizable percentage of the American population, white and black, voting against them. They must think, wait a second, weren't we good to everybody?
Oh, yes. Not only were they shocked, and I've gotten this directly from some individuals, some of my colleagues who've worked in the Clinton campaign, a few who have left, they were not only shocked, they were angry.
Mm.
And they say some of the meetings, strategy meetings, you know, they expressed that anger because they were, you know, someone said, all that we've done for them. And to Bill Clinton's credit and Hillary Clinton's credit, they had expressed and demonstrated a comfort around people of color at a higher level than any presidential couple in the history of this country.
Well,
and
I
they had
that
reached
bit,
out
actually.
To them in a variety of ways. And did things, for instance, when Bill Clinton was president, he showed up unexpected at Hank Aaron's birthday party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was there with Ron Brown's widow, Maynard Jackson's widow, and Ossie Davis's widow. So he has been like a brother, so to speak, in the cultural and social traditions of the black community. And they had taken it for granted. So, you know, we've been laying this groundwork for more than two decades, and how can this young whippersnapper come up and move to the front?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they repaired to the dirty campaign.
Yeah. Do you disagree with that, Professor Harris-Lacewell?
Well, I want to just challenge it a little bit because, on the one hand, there was a comfort level on the part of Bill Clinton and a kind of familiarity with cultural tropes. That's why Toni Morrison called him the first black president. She wasn't making a claim about his race. She was making a claim about the fact that, you know, he was born in the South and had a single mother and liked to eat McDonald's. I mean, these were the things that she'd said, plays the saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I want to challenge is the idea that Hillary Clinton has been equally as sort of comfortable with black cultural tropes, quite the opposite.
Mm.
I think actually she's been very flat-footed. But
oh,
secondly,
yes, but
I also want to argue
and I
that
say she's been comfortable because most of these venues, she has been at his side. So
well,
she is not as skilled
But I will
Bill
say
Clinton.
That as a candidate herself, she's been actually quite flat-footed around sort of African-American cultural norms. And then secondly, those cultural tropes that, on the one hand, Bill Clinton made use of did not go along with a set of policy initiatives or even a set of appointments at the federal level that would have been equally of interest to African-American policy.
Oh, absolutely. And Michael Eric Dyson and others have pointed that out. We've had more African-American males incarcerated during the 8 years of the Clinton administration than all of the other presidents combined throughout history. So you're absolutely right on that basis, Professor Lacewell, but I want to talk to that Toni Morrison. After Bill Clinton began to play the race card, Toni Morrison wrote a letter to the Obama campaign unsolicited, indicated that she supported him and she didn't mean the whole notion of Bill Clinton being the first black president in the way that it's been purveyed. It was more or less tongue-in-cheek. Now, those were Toni Morrison's words, and I have a copy of the letter in my file. But the Clintons have, you know, because they were so far aligned, so closely aligned, at least in a superficial way, with the African-American community, they took it personally when the African-American community began to move toward Barack Obama. And it had not moved toward him at the end. In fact, they've driven the black community in all of the states, because after South Carolina, where was the first opportunity for African-American voters to express their discomfort and anger at right. what the Clintons were doing, the numbers went up. And then they have continued to escalate. But while that was occurring, white voters were still dealing with Barack Obama on his message. And I applaud the voters in Wisconsin, Utah, Iowa, New Hampshire, who voted for him on the basis of the message that he was given rather than considering race as the lead factor.
Well, and, now, what and the Clintons have done, I don't want to suggest that black voters are only voting for him because
he's
black.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm
or
saying
because
the black
they're mad
voters
at,
were voting
at
for
Bill
him.
Clinton, right? I mean, remember that African Americans led this country in our opposition to the war in Iraq, that African Americans were opposed to the war early and consistently, and have in fact been the opinion leaders on the question of Iraq, so that the appeal of Barack Obama in African-American communities is certainly in part related to the excitement and the enthusiasm about having someone who represents the very sort of, you know, culmination of the civil rights movement emerging as a possibility for a black presidency. Oh. But it's also related to, you know, not only his message of hope and optimism and change, but his policy positions, oh, particularly
policy
on the war.
But his policy positions didn't captivate African Americans at first, because he came out for the war in 2000, against the war in 2002. Mm-hmm. And as late as 2007, he was still only in the national polls carrying 36% of the black vote.
Well, because they didn't know who he was.
I think that's
every
right.
Every African American who had an opportunity to vote for him, right. for example, in the state of Illinois, it captured them just fine. He was swept in on a massive
oh, yes, but I'm talking about
grassroots
the national
campaign.
Right.
Well, no, I mean, the early polls that showed Hillary Clinton leading were polls that were really about name recognition. I mean, when you went a year beforehand and asked black and white voters, are you supportive of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama? They literally didn't know what you were talking about.
Yeah.
You know, she had massive name recognition vis-a-vis him. So I actually don't think there was ever a time
well,
in African-American
Well, I would disagree with that because
where
he was still, the vote was still split
Obama.
As he was going into South Carolina. He was less than 50% of the African-American vote, and he had won two primaries. It had started to grow. And you can see a spike in the support, not only nationally, but in South Carolina, after some of the negative statements about his alleged Muslim religion, his him being a drug dealer, and the fairy tale comments that were very offensive to white and minority voters. But to summarize here, what has happened, those tactics drove up his positive, because African-Americans, as you've indicated, Professor Leswell, but not voting on him because he was black.
Right.
They were embracing his policy and embracing his being the culmination of the civil rights movement. In fact, the black masses were ahead of their elected officials in that regard, and they're still ahead of them.
Let me ask about the way the press is treating all of this for a moment, if you don't mind, and then we need to go to a ton of phone calls. I was struck, instead of really concentrating on how large he won Mississippi, and he won it once again, double-digit numbers, huge numbers, the press was looking at the white vote and the black vote, and a lot of the commentary after that race was, oh, he's got to be a little nervous about this after winning 61% because the white vote is going down for him. You know, they're going more to Hillary. So they're parsing the white vote here. What does that mean? What does that press interpretation mean?
I think it's a terrible press interpretation. Barack Obama has built a national multiracial coalition. Hillary Clinton's coalition is almost lily white. And for people to act as though, particularly pundits, to behave as though it's Barack with the single race problem is stunning, because in fact it's Barack has put together black voters, white voters. Now, the fact that white Mississippi voters didn't vote for Barack Obama can only be surprising if you've never read a history book, you've never been awake in America. I mean, like, hello, this is Mississippi, folks. So we're not really shocked that white people in Mississippi who still call themselves Democrats and vote in the Democratic primary were not particularly enthusiastic about voting for Barack Obama. But here's the really important thing to remember. Barack Obama will not carry the state of Mississippi, nor will Hillary Clinton carry the state of Mississippi in the general elections. But what does matter is that although we won't win, meaning Democrats won't win the Electoral College, Mississippi African-American voters are extremely important to state-level decision-making, from mayors to members of the state Senate, the state House, and an enthused and energetic and invigorated Black voting population in Mississippi can be incredibly important for the Democratic Party at a more local level. And so you want to be certain that they have a reason to come to the polls. So, you know, again, if we look at the coalition and we look at who has built a truly national, truly multiracial coalition, it is clear that that is Barack Obama, and that Hillary Clinton's coalition is very, very narrow indeed.
Mm-hmm. Professor Farrell.
Well, I have a slightly different perspective on that, and I think that the press reported what the exit polls showed, you know, and that the negative race-based campaigning of the Clintons did drive down Barack Obama's portion of the white vote in Mississippi. But there was a more significantly more critical issue that Haley Barbour, the Republican governor and ally of George Bush, had his own campaign operatives, and I've been in Mississippi within the last month, out in the field encouraging Republicans to cross a party line.
Crossover, yeah, we've been wondering about that.
To vote for Hillary. Now, that actually happened, and 24% of Hillary's white vote were Republicans crossing party lines at the behest of the governor's campaign machinery. So this was an accident, but at the same time, what Professor Lexwell has said about, you know, conservatism in Mississippi. But if Barack Obama were to win the nomination as a Democrat, I think that there is a high possibility that Mississippi could be put in play, because there would be an enormous turnout of the African-American vote. And he's shown consistently, as she's indicated, in state by state, to do much better than Hillary Clinton among independents. So with the closeness of the Democrat and Republican voter in the state, and Republicans then would have to vote as Republicans, he could possibly pull that.
Oh, that's interesting.
There are southern states I think are in play, North Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee. I got to tell you, I don't think Mississippi is one of them. Just looking at voting patterns, looking at registration around Republicans, looking at the ways in which there is certainly a large African-American population, but if you look at, you know, registration rates, I got to say, I don't think Mississippi is one of the states that is in play. That said, I do think it's important that Democrats stop whistling past Dixie. I don't think that it makes sense to allow a whole part of the country to be not of concern to the national party. I think it is both offensive to the Democrats that live in those states, as well as deeply troubling, again, to our sort of fundamental base of the party. One of the ways that the Republicans have built the massive and impressive national coalition that they did over the past 20 years was by deciding that there would be no safe Democratic seat anywhere in the country. And they ran someone competitively against every Democrat from dog catcher to Senate everywhere in the country. They picked up all kinds of surprising locations because demographic changes happen much more quickly than our census data tell us. So sometimes there are places that, you know, that we just aren't even sure of. So I do think a 50-state strategy is important. That said, I don't think there's anyone who, in counting an electoral college victory necessity, is going to say, well, we've got to win Mississippi to win this thing.
All right, we're going to ask both our guests, and we'll take your phone calls in a moment. We have to pause for a moment. Do they think there's any doubt that Senator Barack Obama will be the nominee of the Democratic Party? We have two guests with us this hour, Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African-American Studies at Princeton University, Professor Walter Farrell, Professor of Management and Community Practice in the School of Social Work, and Associate Director of the Urban Investment Strategies Center. That's part of the Business School at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. To your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Jim Wallace will be joining us, author of The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith and Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. All right, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And We do want to ask everybody to speak one at a time. We're getting, you know, people need to be able to hear what you're saying. We have two great guests, so if we can speak one at a time, that would be great. Thank you. Mohammed from Madison is our first caller here. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
How you doing, Dr. Farrell?
How you doing, Mohammed?
Pretty good, thank you. And to your other guests.
Professor Harris-Lacewell.
What do you think it does to the psyche of the average black person in America when you see someone like Geraldine Ferraro, who, you know, is legend? She, you know, nominated to be vice president of the Democratic Party, come out and play Bakke-like politics in this situation. I didn't even know she was from California. But, you hear someone like in that position make a statement like that. And then you see a person like Barack Obama, who has done all the right things, not perfect, but most of the right things, and he's still confronted with this. And I think this is why, and Dr. Farrell, I think you know what I'm talking about. This is why some even black leadership who would really like to see Barack Obama get the nomination and be president just don't think that the people, whether you're talking about the predominance of white voters or the powers that be, are ready for this now and are going to let this happen.
All right, Mohammed, thanks very much for the call. Dr. Farrell, you want to start?
Oh, yes. No, I think that Mohammed makes a good point, and I don't think that at this point, I really don't think it's the powers that be who are necessarily trying to kneecap Barack Obama in his bid for the presidential nomination and the office of president. But what is happening, I still place all of the blame here on the Clinton campaign, because there have actually been party leaders such as Nancy Pelosi, Ted Kennedy, and numerous others that tell Bill Clinton and the Clinton campaign to back off. You'll need to lower the racial decibels on this whole campaign initiative. And they've refused because they're behind. And I think it has caused disappointment and anger among many segments of the black voting constituency, because they thought that, hey, here's a brother who is qualified and who's going to get a shot to succeed or fail on his own merit.
Mm-hmm.
And they see him being kneecapped at this point by some rather vicious campaign strategy. I don't buy the fact that Clinton surrogates are operating freelance, because you can rein your surrogates in no matter how many you have. And Geraldine Ferraro is from New York, where Hillary Clinton has made her new home, and they've known each other for more than two decades. She could rein in all of her policy advisors, and when they do that, they're doing it with a wink and a nod.
Do you think, Professor Harris-Lacewell, there is any doubt that Senator Barack Obama will be the nominee of the Democratic Party?
Oh, of course there's doubt. Of course there's doubt. There's no question that he is going to win the pledged delegates and that he should be the nominee of the party. But of course there's doubt that he will be. I mean, here is what the Clintons have perfected as a political strategy. It is called the I will wait for history to come to me strategy. Remember that Bill Clinton was impeached during his presidency.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't threatened with impeachment. He was impeached. Most presidents, left or right, Democrat or Republican, would have resigned as a result of impeachment. Bill Clinton said, you know what? I don't think the country actually has a taste for removing me from the White House because of the nature of this impeachment. So I'm just going to stand still. And sure enough, the U.S. Senate was unwilling to actually vote for a removal of the president from office, even though he had been impeached by the House. I think similarly, all that Hillary Clinton has to do now, because she is losing, she's behind in the race,
right,
she cannot win, she has nothing to lose. So what she will do is sit still and then throw every possible punch, send every possible negative campaign ad, I mean, everything that she can, she'll throw it, because she has nothing to lose. And if she waits and hold still, it is possible that the powers of racism, which are still deeply rooted in our country, that someone who is relatively new to the national political scene like Barack might make some sort of mistake, that, you know, all that it would take is sort of one serious stumble or one big mistake, and then she can say to the superdelegates, well, I've lost in the pledge delegates, but clearly the voters didn't know XYZ when they made this decision. It is now your responsibility to save the party by making me the nominee. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's going to carry it to the convention. Mm-hmm. She's going to wait and hold still, and she's going to try to do just what Bill Clinton did during the impeachment.
You agree, Professor Farrell?
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I would just add one caveat, and that fact, you know, and I wholeheartedly agree with her kitchen sink strategy that Hillary Clinton would continue to throw everything at Barack Obama. But by doing this, the overall strategy is to drive down consistently his percentage of the white vote. So she can use that to make the case that white people won't vote for this guy, whether anything falls out of Obama's past or not. That would be the argument that she will go to the convention with, that white Democrats will not vote for him, although they voted for him earlier. But now they've changed without saying it because I've helped them to change. Mm. And this escalated after Virginia, where he came within five. He almost split white women with Hillary Clinton in Virginia, 47 to 52.
Yeah, it's true. It's changed, right.
He carried white men. He did that in Maryland. And they say, wait, we got to stop it. That's when the kitchen sink strategy
comes out. Yeah, interesting.
I think that Professor Lacewell's observation, they say, if I sit still and throw this dirt, that would be my selling point at the convention.
All right, let's go to Aisu from Kenosha. Hi, Aisu.
Hi, Kathleen. Your show is awesome.
Thanks.
Okay, I just wanted to say, I just believe that the discussion about race in this country has just been misplaced since jump. It's always been about being colorblind, but being colorblind is just the wrong path. It allows us to ignore the diversity. It allows us to ignore the color. It allows us to ignore, like, what really makes, like, the different things that different cultures have to offer. It's like looking, like being colorblind, looking at a rainbow. You miss the colors. You miss the point. And second of all, the Barack Obama is just a better politician. He's been able to use everything that he has and does not have to his advantage. So I think, and if you really dissect Geraldine Ferraro's comments, I think it was a poor comment, but it mostly goes to that. He's been able to use being black to his advantage, and just because he's better at being a politician than the other one is.
And how's he been able to use being black to his advantage?
I think he's been able to use being black to his advantage by just recognizing it's tied into the whole thing of hope, you know, because the bottom line, America has a conscience that has never wavered. It is the one thing that was built into the Constitution. And that conscience, you know, makes Americans feel bad about what has happened, you know, our racist past and things like that. And, you know, and there's been so many people who have not gotten what they have deserved. You know, a black man has to be extra to just be ordinary, to be considered ordinary. And, you know, and there's this, and I think America has had enough, but we've misplaced this argument for so long. And I think for once he's kind of putting it where it belongs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have to move on. Professor Harris-Lacewell, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes back to one of my earlier comments, which is as important as it is to decry the bad behavior of the Clinton campaign, it's also very important for us to take a look at why are these strategies, which the Clintons feel will be effective, why are we afraid of a conversation about race? Mm-hmm. Now, I disagree that Barack uses his blackness to his advantage.
Right.
I do think that he uses his sort of complex family narrative as a way of connecting with many voters. I mean, we saw this in 2004 at the DNC speech when he started talking about who his grandfather was and who his mother was and who his father was and who his wife is and who his children are. I mean, there isn't a person standing in that convention hall who couldn't relate to his story. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, just like Bill Clinton used his up from hope and, you know, Reagan used his celebrity, every candidate for the U.S. presidency makes use of their personal biography as a way of connecting with voters. That is very different than saying America enjoys and wants a black president because we're just sort of into affirmative action. And it's a particularly bizarre thing to say when he's running against a candidate who is a candidate for the U.S. presidency because she has a tight familial connection to a recent president of the United States. I mean, it just is beyond the pale from my perspective for anyone to behave as though Hillary Clinton is a self-made politician who struggled up from the bottom. She is a privileged wife of a former president who, while she has made her own political contributions, undoubtedly, is truly only a candidate for the presidency because she once lived in the White House. It is as distressing as George W. Bush becoming president because he shares the name and the family with George H.W. Bush.
And you talk about his narrative, Professor Farrell, you can't help but be struck by this man's narrative. The grandmother in Kenya and the visits there, he goes beyond the United States, really, in a way that I don't know any other candidate in U.S. history has.
I think that the Barack Obama, the story of his life is truly an American story. And that is what has helped him to build the coalition that Professor Lacewell referenced. That whites are impressed by that, whether they live in rural areas, urban areas, whether they are in overwhelmingly white states or diverse states. People have embraced that narrative, especially when he is using it to encourage unity politically in a country where there has been gross disunity over the past decade. And so the fact that he is African-American in that sense is incidental. That's not the thrust of his campaign. And he doesn't run away from it, but he doesn't use it for any extra advantage.
Yeah.
He is what Barack Obama has put forth is a more compelling message than Hillary Clinton. And all of the technical solution-based messages that she's put forth, and she's put forth several messages over the past year, they haven't struck a chord. And that has forced them into the kitchen sink.
Yeah, let's go to Alice from Menominee. Hi, Alice.
Hi. We were visiting with some friends the other night, and they made some comments, and I was absolutely shocked. and it has to do with being colorblind. And their statement was, well, if Obama is wins the nomination, that they would not vote for him. And it was absolutely a racist thing. I was absolutely shocked. And yet when I listened to the professor just now talking about how the blacks won't vote for Hillary, I'm wondering if this is not really going to be a race. And that when it all comes down to his getting the nomination, that all those white people out there that we thought we've made so much progress with racism, when they get behind those curtains, it's going to come down to race.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me. We're talking about the Democratic Party here, Professor Harris Lacewell. We're talking about Democrats. And look at what's happening with this issue. You wouldn't expect
it. Democrats are the party of the white primary. Democrats are the party that would not seat Fannie Lou Hamer in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
That was a while ago, though, right?
Well, it's in my parents' living memory. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. So I think we do have to be careful about imagining that Democrats are somehow, you know, over and above and unconcerned with. Now, that said, I do think it's unfair to imagine that the primary motivator for either black or white voters is race. Black voters always vote for white presidential candidates. We're not racist. We're perfectly capable of doing it. So I don't think that that's a possibility. I also believe that while there certainly is a percentage of white American voters who will never vote for a black candidate, what I would call a kind of naked racism vote, No doubt about it, there is a group. Some of them are in the Republican Party. Some of them are in the Democratic Party. But there's really nothing we can do about them. We can't convince them. We can't cajole them. Mm. They'll never vote for a black candidate. But I think that the vast middle ground is neither people who will only vote for a white candidate nor blacks who will only vote for a black candidate, but that the vast number of Americans are saying, hey, I'm willing to vote for somebody who I think will win in my party, who I believe will improve our economy, who I think will get us out of this horrendous war in Iraq, who I believe will somehow, you know, handle these kind of fundamental crises that seem to be facing our country around everything from mortgages to health care. I mean, I just have a little bit more faith in my country, even recognizing the stickiness of white supremacy, even recognizing the stickiness of misogyny and patriarchy. I also believe that Americans are often led to be better than they are at the moment that they are feeling that way. That in Selma, there were white people who stood up in Selma and said, enough is enough. This is not what America's about. We're going to do better. And we'll only know if we go ahead and are brave enough to try.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guests are Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University, Professor Walter Farrell, who lived in Milwaukee for a number of years and was at UWM. He's a professor of Management and Community Practice, School of Social Work, and Associate Director of the Urban Investment Strategies Center at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. More of your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Wallace, our guest the second hour today. His latest book is The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith and Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. Back to phone calls. Barbara from Spring Green. Hello, Barbara. Barbara, are you there?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Are people forgetting that Barack Obama has a white mother? Are we minimalizing that fact? And I think that anybody who can't extract the message from the rhetoric these days isn't getting it. So hopefully people will listen to the message and not all this discussion of race. That's about all I have to say.
All right. And is this discussion likely to go on and on, Professor Farrell?
Oh, absolutely. And I would respond to Barbara. I think one thing that Barack Obama has always been clear to do at the beginning of his narrative is to acknowledge his mother and her race.
Right. He went to Kansas and met some relatives.
He was and his grandmother and his grandfather who raised him. Mm-hmm. He's been very clear about that, has never tried to minimize it in any way. And the only person who's been minimized in that whole narrative was his father, who he only saw to his memory twice, once in his life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the whole issue here is that he is the type of candidate that has appealed to a broad audience. And relative to the earlier comment by Alice, my point was that black people will not vote for Hillary Clinton because I think the majority of blacks, if she were to wrest the nomination some way, would vote for her overwhelmingly. She won't get turnout.
Yeah.
And turnout will seal her fate, that there will not be the enthusiasm of voting for her like there was not the enthusiasm of voting for John Kerry in 2004, who got 3% less of the black vote than Al Gore did in 2000. So I think it would be enthusiasm. People will, if this continues, unless they resolve it, people will become disconcerted, and I think voters across racial lines will just opt out.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true, Melissa?
I'm absolutely certain that that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't even tell you, because I write on a national blog, I get dozens of emails every day from not only black, but let me be very clear, white supporters, young supporters, people who have been brought into the process because of Barack, who are saying, you know, I can't do it. I just can't cast a vote. In fact, sometimes very tortured and saying, what do I do? Should I vote for Nader? I can't, you know, I can't not be a voter. Should I go and just vote, you know, dog catcher to Senate and leave the presidency blank? I mean, really kind of a tortured sense of I just cannot bring myself to vote for someone whose campaign strategies look like this. Now, I want to respond very quickly to your caller. Again, I think this goes to why, as troubling as this all is, I'm actually pleased, as someone who studies and researches race, that as troubling as this is, that maybe it could lead us to a conversation about race, that Americans have a tendency to want to say, shush, 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 hush, don't talk about it, don't talk about it, it's divisive. No, we need to talk about it. Even the notion of that calling Barack black or talking about his blackness somehow dishonors his white mother is ahistorical. It doesn't recognize that many black Americans have white parents or white grandparents, but one was still perfectly enslavable, even if your parent was white, that you would still have been subject to Jim Crow, mm-hmm. that it was very late in the American national game before interracial marriage was even legal, and that, in fact, having a white parent does not wipe away blackness in this country. It simply never has. And so this would be a good moment for us to have a conversation about how race is complicated, that many black Americans have either a white parent or grandparent or great-grandparent, but that blackness is this powerful thing that we both choose and that is chosen for us.
I agree with you. If we have a conversation at that level, I'm afraid that it's not at that level.
No, it's not, but we could, and I say by we, I just mean folks committed to racial healing in America, we could take these offensive, awful comments by people like Geraldine Ferraro, and we could say, all right, that's offensive and awful. How can we make something good out of it? How can we use this as an opportunity for public discourse for racial healing instead of racial division?
Yeah. All right, as long as we're stirring up the pot here, let's take let's take gender into account as well. The Rolling Stone magazine has a really interesting issue this month in which they write a glowing endorsement of Barack Obama. There's an article about Hillary Clinton, I don't know if you've seen this, both of you, by Matt Taibbi, and he writes this: the anger over the perceived sexist treatment of Hillary is very real. After Iowa, I began to run into women on the campaign trail who were furious over the success of Obama, seeing in it evidence that the public is incapable of accepting a woman as an authority figure, retreating instead to the familiar embrace of yet another seductive man offering the same old empty promises. Of course, because you're female, Melissa, we'll give that to you first, if you don't mind.
Sure. I mean, is sexism real? Undoubtedly. Is patriarchy, you know, painfully affecting the lives of women? No doubt about it. Are white women more likely to win public office at every level than black men? Uh-huh. So I think we got to be really, really careful about this. Sexism is real. There have been times when journalists have said wretched and terrible things about Hillary Clinton, when the blogosphere has done things which are beyond the pale in terms of sex. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton only sort of attaches herself to a feminist label when it is useful for her. She has failed to adequately address questions of, for example, black women, brown women, and working class women around the country. We too are women. She failed in the case of this new scandal with New York's Governor Eliot Spitzer involved in an international ring of prostitution to say, hey, as a feminist politician, it is unacceptable. I now denounce and reject Eliot Spitzer, his support, his financial support, because I refuse to be associated with someone who traffics in women's bodies, right? No, no words like that. So, yes, sexism is real. Yes, patriarchy is real. Yes, sexism is sometimes used against Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton is not a feminist politician. Hillary Clinton has not done what I would expect a feminist politician to do, and white women are consistently more able to win every level of public office than our black men.
All right, let's go to
more so than women of color.
One more phone call, which is probably, I wish we could talk about this all day. It's really a good discussion. We'll talk about it again. Karen from Lafayette County, hi.
Good morning. I have been listening to this discussion, and I was a little concerned because I'm really upset with this tempest in a teapot about Geraldine Ferraro. She was on NPR's very own Talk of the Nation, I believe it was the last part of last week, and she was talking about this. She was pretty much talking the same thing. Nobody was calling up. They were very upset about that, that they came out, that, what is it, Axelrod from the Obama campaign came out and started screaming about on Monday. And in the course of the discussion, there was nothing wrong with what she was saying. She was just pointing out how, you know, hard it was when she was first the vice presidential candidate then, and how things have moved. And yet, are we really ready for either a black president or even a female president? She was taking it more or less in that context. So when I hear this coming up, I'm very, very, very disappointed with the Obama campaign, and I'm very, very, very much considering my my vote. It was for him. It'll probably
so you didn't find anything offensive about the comments that have been getting all the press? If Obama was a white man, he would not be in this position.
Out of context. There was a lot more to that.
All right, let's go to Professor Farrell on that.
I've read all of the comments by Geraldine Ferraro that were printed in various newspapers, in quotes, and also her comments on several on Good Morning America, Today Show, trying to clean it up. The most recent television commentaries are instances of her trying to clean up her earlier offensive comments, and then she tried to flip the script by saying, I'm being attacked because I'm a white woman.
Right.
She raised it. It was offensive. It's been viewed as offensive, not only by David Axelrod, but millions of American voters.
And on that note, we're out of time. Thank you both so much for being with us. It was a great hour. Please come back again, both of you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Our thanks to Professor Walter Farrell, Professor of Management and Community Practice, School of Social Work at UNC, where he's also Associate Director of the Urban Investment Strategies Center, Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, who's Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University. We'll do this again next week, shouldn't we? I think it's a fascinating issue, and as she says, we got to talk about these issues. We got at an elevated level, we have to talk about issues of race in this country. All right. Well, we got news, and then we'll return on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.